to record.
This is for Danny Haynes.
Right, left. One of these.
Is that okay right there? That's fine.
That one right there is black.
I've got 7:30, so let's go ahead and get started.
This is a Song of Solomon. It moved. Okay.
Just never know, do you? Just never know.
All right. I haven't heard the bell, so let's get started. Welcome to Lesson 2 on Sermon on the Mount. If you don't have material, I'll make some more and have it available on Sunday. But it is online. I meant to say this. We are using Russ's material. I changed a few things on Lesson 1. But other than that, this is Russ's material. It's Russ's outline that we'll get to. So, in a lot of what I have to say basically comes from Russ. I don't say it near as well as he does. So, good evening.
Hi.
And I asked Eric if he would teach for us. And I think he agreed, as long as his wife works with us on this. Of course, you've got a few weeks that you can have the child and allow him to teach, all right? So, Eric, I've got you in for 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. You all right with that?
Okay.
And I'll come back and I'll do the last one there in the conclusion. Since Marty's here, I'm glad I included this. Since I was in his class just recently on how to teach, I'm not real sure I ever passed the class, so I'm not sure I'm approved to teach, but here I am anyways. I didn't bring this up in the first lesson, but I'll just ask you this. I had list two reasons for the Jews' misunderstanding of the kingdom of heaven. And the second objective for the class was, for the first class, was to explain the meaning of the kingdom of heaven. And that's important to us when we get to the Beatitudes, the first and the eighth, that we'll get to tonight, or at least the first one we'll get to. I'm going to answer that for you. It's not unfair, and I'll give you lesson two objectives in a minute. So this is kind of the summary slide of where we reach near the end of the class Sunday. And that is, it was God's purpose to establish a kingdom with His Son as the king. And where does the king sit? Where is the kingdom? He sits in heaven on His throne. He has graciously extended that kingdom to earth. This kingdom, it isn't characterized by worldly standards of military, economic, and political power, but it's a kingdom of righteousness. It's a spiritual kingdom designed out of heaven where the king is reigning. And the king is looking for those who have certain characteristics. These are the individuals who willingly submit to his rule. It's those who realize that our citizenship is in heaven. Philippians 3:20. I concluded, and this is basically Sewell's definition. He's got 13 lessons on the kingdom. His conclusion is, the kingdom of heaven is God's rule in the hearts of those who willingly submit to Him through the king. And I made the point that this verse, Matthew 11:11, where Jesus says, "Assuredly, I say to you, among those born of women, there is not risen one greater than John the Baptist, but he who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he." All of those, the kingdoms that we looked at on Sunday, as we looked at this idea of the kingdom of heaven, those were shadows of what God was trying to do in bringing about the real king to come, the humble king who would sit on this throne forever. And so we are now part of a king, we are in a kingdom through a king And this kingdom is characterized by the perfect king, a perfect law, a sacrifice, high priest, and perfect citizens. Not that we are perfect, but we're made that way because of the grace and the mercy of the actions of the king for us. And so the old covenant, that kingdom, was looking forward to this new one that we can be a part of through the king. So those who recognize Christ as our Lord and whose lives he is reigning are in the kingdom of heaven, and the kingdom of heaven is in us. Correct. I actually removed one row of seats there because the door always hit people. I shouldn't have done that. But I think the Sermon on the Mount reflects the central theme of God that he wanted for himself a people. Exodus 19, we saw where he wanted a people to be a holy nation and a kingdom of priests. But we find out that this nation, the Jews, Psalm 106 says that they mingled with the nations and they learned their practices and served their idols. They ceased to be different. And they ceased to be God's people, and we must be different. We have chosen a path where we're willing to say we want to be different. And we know we will find out how to be different from the king of this kingdom. And that's what we read about in the Sermon on the Mount. How to be different. How to be this royal priesthood and holy nation under God. So leading up to the sermon, it's the second year of his ministry. He's teaching in the synagogues. He's preaching the gospel of the kingdom. He's healing all kinds of sicknesses. Great multitudes are coming to him. His fame has spread. And we see that there's a lot of different people coming from a lot of different regions in the area to see Jesus. We did mention this, that the background of this, what was true of the religion at the time. What's some words we could use for that? Some adjectives? Is that
hypocritical?
Hypocritical, absolutely. And thus it was shallow. The people, they were poisoned by the things that the scribes and the Pharisees taught. And they were focused on what? What was their main focus when they looked at the law? How did they zap the law of its meaning? What did they focus in on? The outward or the inward?
The outward.
The outward, man. Obviously, they were occupied by Rome. It was a world of absolute leaders. The people were just property for the Romans. Slavery, it was rampant during this time. Racial prejudice was prevalent. And we said in the midst of all of that, this lowly Galilean carpenter ascended the hillside and gave perhaps the most famous sermon of all time. The one that is diametrically opposed to the currents of the day, of his day, into our day as well. So here's the outline, and then hopefully we'll get started. Matthew 5, 1 through 12, we'll read about the Beatitudes, which we will start tonight. 13 through 16, Christians living in the world, and we have the similitudes. What do we find in there? That we are to be what?
Salt.
Yes. The key verse. What do we say the key verse was? Verse 20. You shall not inherit the kingdom of heaven. All right. And so I think what he does here is he turns right around right after saying that. He gives six examples of how their righteousness must exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. And that's where we read, you heard it said of old, but I say to you, and we're going to talk about what that means. It's important that we understand what he's doing when he makes those comments. We get to the public and the private deeds, the giving and the praying and the fasting. How you should do that as opposed to what you see with the pattern of the scribes and the Pharisees. Focusing once again on the inner man as opposed to the outward actions. Then we get into proper judgment, the one verse that everybody knows in the Bible, 7:1. Judge not that you be not judged. Then we're going to get into prayer, persistence, and it's going to lead to two choices when we get to the end. And we have a choice, and I hope when we get to the end of this book, you'll be ready to make the choice that the king wants you to make. And we can choose, when we hear these words, we can choose to do them. And if we do them, we'll be like the wise man who built his house on the rock as opposed to the one who built his house on the sand. And great
was the fall. I couldn't find any picture that really looked like a great fall. So, I had two goals for here, and I actually brought this up, Marty. You tell me if this is really a goal. I said, you know, maybe this is more of the objective, because the objective are the things I want you to be able to do at the end of the class. The goal is how I want you to think and act differently at the end of the class. So I would like us to be able to learn the character, the calling, and the quality of the kingdom citizens' righteousness. And then once we know that, decide to more completely remove self and be filled with the character of Jesus, and follow his example that we saw in the last class of loving righteousness and hating wickedness. If we can do that, we've come a long way. So, lesson two objectives, I'd like to be able to explain what poor in spirit means and why it is essential for entrance into the kingdom of heaven, and then give two examples of individuals who display a poor spirit, and state why mourning would be a natural result of one who is poor in spirit. So hopefully at the end of the class we'll be able to do that. I want to mention one other thing about the audience. Who is listening to Jesus? So when we get into verse 1 and 2, we see that the crowds came, and they are listed as his disciples. He sat down, which is a normal spot for one who's going to teach, for a rabbi. So he sits down, the disciples came to him, he opened up his mouth. But the question is it just his followers who were there?
It's more than disciples. It's a multitude of people.
So when you look at the very end, it says, when Jesus had finished these words, the crowds were amazed at what he taught. You look at Luke 6, which is the Sermon on the Plain, and you look at who was there, you can see that there was a large crowd. His disciples were there, but there was a great throng of people. So I think it's more than just those who were following. There's those who wanted to hear what he said, perhaps weren't following. They were just interested and curious. Perhaps there are those who wanted to trap Jesus. There's probably a lot of different people represented in this audience than just those who were following him. When we get to the very end of the sermon, it talks about how these people responded, how they reacted to what he taught. What word do you see up here? How did they react?
Amazed.
They were amazed. They were amazed at what he taught. Why is that? Why would they be amazed at the way that he taught?
The son of a common person, I guess, uneducated.
Yeah, that's one thing. I mean, where did he
wasn't a Levite.
Yeah. Where did he actually learn all of this information? Yes, Dan.
Yeah, so they would have taught. Well, we've read this, we've studied this, we've come to this conclusion. Jesus said, I am the truth.
Yeah.
You know, so he's saying things specifically about himself that he's not getting his authority or his understanding from something. He is the understanding. He is the authority.
And so he taught, this is the way it is. Not this is what I heard. No, he is the... And if you go back to chapter 1 and verse 23, the prophecy, it says, behold, the virgin shall be with the child and shall bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. He taught as one who is God. He is the King. And that's how he taught. And so they listened to him and they were amazed, and we need to listen to the words of the King and be amazed and be ready to respond to it. Beatitudes, yes,
for whatever it's worth, at the end of the sermon it says, and he finished these sayings. There's five times in the Gospel of Matthew where that statement is made that he finished these sayings.
Yeah.
And so there's five major sections of teaching from Jesus in Matthew. And Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible, and it makes you wonder if there's some connection between him being presented as the new Moses or something like that.
Oh, wow. Thanks for that point. So most of you probably, in your Bible, you have a section before verse 1 that says Beatitudes, or verse 3 that says Beatitudes. The question is, where does that word come from? It is a Latin word. The Latin is Beatus. So somehow they got Beatitudes out of that. And it means blessed or to make happy. But why is the word happy, really not the best use, the best way to translate this, if you're talking about happy the way that we describe happy.
Well, at least in the way we describe happy, it's more for like an emotion, as opposed to like an attitude change or an attitude shift. Of like joy, we usually say like joy versus happiness. One's an attitude, one's an emotion.
Right. Yeah, that's true. So my happiness here might be based on the way that Rose treats me, or whether she made good food tonight, both of those type of things. External things, that's obviously not what this is talking about. Now, this is talking about something that is much deeper, and it's from this Greek word makarios. Well, what that means, and that is translated blessed in all these different versions of the Bible. I don't think there's anything else. Eric, I didn't check the Teen Extreme Bible for you, so I don't know if it's a...
That one's super happy.
It's super happy. All the other ones are blessed. That means to be fully satisfied. In classical Greek, this word, it describes those who possess consummate bliss. All right, so the English word that contains for happiness contains the root word hap, which means chance. And this type of happiness is something that is dependent on the chances and the changes of life, something which life may give and which life may also destroy. Yes, Eric?
It seems to me described happiness as dependent on what's happening in your life.
Yes.
So I think that's an easy one.
Yes, Martin.
And yet, just to say the word happy, sometimes we're happy because just we feel good or something.
Yeah.
But I think there's a passive version, voice of this. Blessed means blessed, means I have been blessed by something. Mm. Right? And I think the word more is just fortunate, or God has favored this person. That concept is in there somewhere.
Right.
So it is an externally created thing. Like when we bless the bread, the bread's not happy.
Right.
You know what I mean? But what we're doing is we've been giving thanks for its great value. I think somehow this grows out of the value we have, so God is praising us or making us fortunate. You hear those words too, happy,
right.
Fortunate.
Yes, Danny.
Yeah, so you consider some of the things that he's going to discuss, like for example, mercy. You know, blessed are they that are merciful. The fact that I have to be merciful indicates I've been violated in some way. Something has happened to me, and so that causes a specific reaction. The last thing is I'm going to be really happy about this situation. Mm-hmm. And God's going to call me, or in this case, Jesus is going to call me to do something very difficult, very challenging, to show mercy to someone when that's not going to be my inclination. My inclination is going to want to get justice. And so what I think he's saying, like Marty's alluding, there is a benefit. There is a blessing that comes as an outcome that I may not fully appreciate or understand at the moment, but he's calling me to do something very
difficult. Each phrase says for. Here's why. Here's why they're fortunate. Here's why they're worthy of praise or something. It's kind of a...
Right. Great points. So this is based upon a person who is satisfied not because of what's the external circumstances, but because he indwells the believer through Christ. That's how God looks at us. We're blessed because God approves of us. So, William Barclay wrote, that joy which is serene and untouchable and self-contained, that joy which is completely separate and independent of all the chances and the changes of life. So what we see are a list of character traits on the left-hand side. Okay, and poor in spirit, mourn, meek, hunger, thirst for righteousness, merciful, pure in heart, peacemakers, persecuted for righteousness, and then on the right-hand side, there's a promise for each of these. It's interesting. So are there seven Beatitudes or eight? You know, this one is a little bit different, isn't it? But yet, if you look at why this person is actually persecuted, why is it? Yeah, because they are a certain type of person. They are righteous. And they're being persecuted for that. Their life results in them being persecuted. So the point I want to make up front is it's not like because I was born a certain way and I feel like, you know, I'm full of mercy and so therefore I'm just going to pick one of these and because I'm merciful or because I am persecuted, that's all I need. No, you've got to have all of these. You can't just pick one. It's like the fruit of the Spirit. You need all of these things. The Christian has to, if you're going to be a citizen of the kingdom of heaven, you've got to be able to put a check mark by all of these. Right? So you can't just pick and choose. These qualities are chosen qualities. You have to decide, this is who I want to be. This is what I want to be. And you've got to reach out and take them. Because you aren't born with these qualities. At all. You've got to decide you want them and reach out and take them. One question that you had in your lesson asked about, which of these seem kind of odd, kind of hard to grasp? Let's see what it says. List beatitudes that are most difficult for you to understand and explain why. So on the left-hand side, which one of these do you have a hard time grasping and understanding what it might mean?
Well, maybe to Danny's point, the word is happy. Happy are those that mourn. That's almost
It don't make any sense, right?
Yeah. You get the word for that. Oxymoron. Thank you.
Yeah. Yep. That doesn't make a lot of sense. So how is it that I'm going to be happy if I mourn? Because a lot of times I have mourned and I haven't turned out to be happy after the mourning process. So yeah, that one's kind of unusual. Any other ones on the left-hand side?
Pure in heart. Hmm. How do you quantify purity of your heart? How can it be measured?
Yeah, it's a hard one as well.
I was going to say, to be falsely accused and treated, that's a happy thing.
Yeah.
Okay. If that's how you go look at it.
How about being poor in spirit? I mean, that just seems odd to me. You would think it would say, blessed are the one who's rich in spirit, not the one who's poor in spirit. Why is that? And then this idea of mourning, as Marty said, and then meek. So you have a new employee who began work, and they came and said, hey, we got Bob here as a new employee. He's so meek. Do we think about that as being a positive thing or a negative thing?
In our sense, it's a negative thing.
Yeah, well, how is it good then that I'm meek and how am I going to inherit the earth? And then when I get to this other side, what does that mean, inherit the earth? Because I've already been told that if I'm poor in spirit, I get the kingdom of heaven. And so which is it? Do I get the kingdom of heaven? Do I get the earth? And then here it is at the bottom. And then I ask, well, when exactly do I get this kingdom of heaven? You know, when I die and judgment comes, and then I get the kingdom. So all these things can be a little difficult to understand, but we're going to go through them. Over the next three lessons, we will go over the Beatitudes and also the Similitudes. I just want to say this as well. Do you agree with me that what Jesus is saying, and in particular these Beatitudes and all that he says in the sermon, the emphasis is on the character over doctrine? It's who you are over what you do. Because, well, let's call these. These are all kind of the same side of the coin. What we are over what we do, and the internal man over the external man. If you're focused just on, okay, I need to do exactly what Jesus said at the right time, so he says, don't say fool. So I can't say fool, but I say everything else. And I have to think, okay, if somebody asks for my coat, and I have to give them a cloak, and it says that I have to rip off my right arm and also pluck out my eye. So I think it is important, obviously, that we do the right things, but what's most important is that the right things are flowing out of the right heart. And if you have the right heart, if you put on these qualities, when you come into a case where a person comes up and asks for your cloak or your coat, you're going to naturally do what one who is poor in spirit and meek and merciful, you will do what you ought to do because you are what you ought to be on the inside. And so I'm saying that this sermon is focused on who we are over what we do. And when you get that right, what you do will flow just naturally from
what you are. So poor in spirit. The Greek word for poor is there. It means one who has absolutely nothing and is completely empty. Abject poverty. And we look at that word, we find the exact same word in James 2. And so if a man comes into your assembly with a gold ring and dressed in fine clothes, and there also comes in a poor man with dirty clothes. So that's the same word. It's talking about a person who has nothing. If you think of Lazarus at the gate of the rich man, there was nothing he could do to say, hey, this is, you owe me this. He had a great need. He needed food. He was willing to take the crumbs that fell off of the table. He had nothing that he could come to the rich man and say, okay, give me this, because, no, he was begging, he was pleading. And so this idea of begging and pleading is in here. The person has absolutely nothing. But you think, once again, that it ought to say, like, rich in spirit. Blessed are the poor in spirit. It says, blessed are the rich. Doesn't make a lot of sense. And this word for spirit, pneuma, is used different ways, obviously, in the Bible. But here, I think it's referring to the inner part of man. It's our minds, our attitudes, our way of thinking. It has to do with that part of us that has to do with our relationship to God. Okay, so in some sense, in my dealings with God, I need to be poor. So let's look into that to find out what it is. But first, let's ask what it's not. Somebody throw this out to me. Luke 18:10. How is the Pharisee in Luke 18 not a good example of being poor in spirit?
He prays all the wrong things.
Yeah. Well, and he's comparing, is that the word he's comparing? Yeah. He's comparing himself to the wrong person.
Yes. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, one a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and was praying this to himself, God, I thank you that I'm not like other people, swindlers, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. Poor in spirit? No. How about the scribes in Luke 20 and Mark 2? I'll read those really quick, a few of them. Beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and love greetings in the marketplace, in chief seats in the synagogues, in places of honor at banquets. And then in 2:16, when the scribes and the Pharisees saw that Jesus was eating with sinners and the tax collectors, they said to his disciples, why is he eating and drinking with tax collectors and sinners? Jesus heard it, and he says, it is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. I did not come to call the righteous, but to call the sinners. It's not like the church in Laodicea. What did they say in Revelation 3:17? I'm rich, I have become wealthy, I have need of nothing. It's not those who boast in their birth, or their family, or their nationality, education, the physical looks, race, wealth, or their culture. You can cross-reference Paul in that. Philippians 3, you consider that all rubbish. It's not those who are self-reliant, self-confident, self-centered, or self-sufficient. We're not talking about those who are poor in terms of monetary wealth. We're not talking about those who are weak or cowardly, like the spies in Numbers 13 who said, we're not able to go up against these people. It's not a false humility. It says, oh, you know, I'm nothing. But what is it? So let's take just a moment. And yes, Ronnie?
What I wrestle with a little bit is that poor generally means lacking, doesn't it?
Yes.
We're lacking.
Abject poverty.
Yeah, this is good.
Uh-huh.
It says poor in the spirit. So to understand this, and I'm not saying you're headed that way, you hadn't already told me.
No, go ahead.
It's poor in some kind of spirit.
Yes.
And it must not be a good thing, right? Because we're blessed, but we're poor in the spirit. I don't.
Well, let's look at these examples, and y'all can explain it to me. Back row, take Isaiah 6, 1 through 5, and you're going to tell me how it is that this person is poor in spirit. Next group with Danny and that whole row, you can take Luke 5, 8, but look at it in context, and also explain it to me in context. Marty's row, Luke 18, 13, and 14, and then Cornelius and front row, James, Luke 15, 21. Just take like 3 or 4 minutes and just let me know. You can explain to me how these people represented a poor spirit in reference to God. Okay, it sounds like most people have stopped talking. Alright, let's start with the first one. Let me just read this. In the year, this is Isaiah, in Isaiah 6, in the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. Seraphim stood above him, each having six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his wings, his feet, and with two he flew. And one called out to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the threshold trembled at the voice of him who called out, while the temple was filling with smokes. Then I said, "Woe is me, for I am ruined, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Talk to me about how he is poor in spirit in this case.
I guess from that perspective, he had been, he felt in several episodes, unworthier or undeserving.
Yes. What did he see? It said he saw
the King, the Lord of hosts, Jehovah.
Yeah.
And he saw how lacking he was.
Yes.
In spirituality and everything. Probably of the things that he was doing here on earth, he thought was right.
So, if we were to put ourselves in his position, when we're thrust into the presence of God, don't you think he would feel the exact same way? I mean, there's nothing I bring to God which I can lay claim to him or hold over him. No, there's nothing that I have. And so, in this case, I think he shows this sense of poorness in spirit, recognizing this vast difference between himself and God. And he says, what about himself? I am what?
Undone, what the American Standard says.
Yeah, I'm ruined. I am a man of unclean lips. What does he seem to be implying there? That he has what? He's guilty of sin.
as he stands before the holy and righteous God.
Surrounded by that truth.
Yes. Why would he feel this way? I think it's because of his sin. Okay, Luke 5:8. What happened in Luke? What's the background of this? Danny,
you're right. So a large multitude, so much so that Jesus is being pressed by them by the shore. So there's two boats there. Apparently some fishermen have been fishing there. They're out of their boats cleaning the nets. And he uses one of the boats to be able to speak and teach the multitudes. And after the teaching is over, he then turns to Peter and asks him to throw out his nets into the water. And Peter, being the professional fisherman that he is, knowing that they had toiled all day, there's obviously no fish here, explains to Jesus that, but he goes ahead and does it anyway. And then when they pull the nets in, there's so much fish, the nets are breaking. They need help from the other boat. And so from this, Peter concludes that there is something very special about Jesus, to where he recognizes his nature is different than the nature that Jesus possesses. And so he immediately looks at himself so sinful that he does not deserve to be in the presence of Jesus.
Yes, great. Like you said, he fell down at his feet. He says, "Go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man." And he saw exactly what you said, which I think is the same thing that Isaiah saw. In relation to this holiness, he's nothing. He's sinful. But there is absolutely no comparison between himself and God and himself and Jesus here. And so, you know, I believe it's Russ who used the... He said, you know, when you see him falling at Jesus' feet, he said what to Jesus? Yeah. Do you think he really wanted him to leave? Russ said, you know, you can see him falling down and grabbing a hold of his ankles when he said it, because he realizes there's, you know, this is what he needs. Even though there's this great gap between him and Jesus, he realizes he's the one that he needs to go to. He recognized his sin, he recognized his own worthlessness, and that resulted in this poorness of spirit. And then Luke 18, what do we have in Luke 18? We already brought that up. The tax collector, talk to me about the... Or the Pharisee, talk to me about the tax collector. Which one of you six? What did he say that shows that he was poor in spirit?
So this is the opposite guy to whom we mentioned before.
Yes.
So instead of praying and exalting himself and mentioning everything good that he did, this guy prays that God will be merciful to him and recognizes that he's a sinner.
Yes.
So he said that we noticed he was very self-reflective, and his perception of himself was not more high than what it ought to have been.
Right. Great. So he saw between himself and God this great gap, right? And he knew that he was a sinful man, and his need for God. And so he was poor in spirit, as opposed to the tax or to the Pharisee. And this last one, last group, what do we see in the last example?
The lost son. This is a story I think we read a lot. We go through it all the time, but we were just talking about, he goes, "Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you." But first he says heaven.
Yeah.
That's impactful to some degree, that he recognizes he's sinned against heaven before his own father. And then it goes on to say, "I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." Mm-hmm. And I don't, you know, we can't see his facial expression, but I don't think he's expecting to get the fat and calf out of this. I don't think he's expecting out of it. He just wants to be a hired hand. Just wants to come back into his father's arms. So that's not foreign spirit. You know, it's impactful.
And it says that at that point, the text says he came to himself, he went back to his father. As you said, he said, "I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." I think we see in all of those examples the fact that what poor in spirit is, Jesus, God said, "But to this man will I look, even to him."
that is poor and of a contrite spirit, and trembleth at my word. In Isaiah 57, for thus says the high and exalted one, who lives forever and whose name is holy, I dwell on a high and holy place, and also with the contrite and the lowly, for the poor and the humble of spirit. God made it clear the type of people he's looking for. Martin Lloyd-Jones, in his book, defined the poor in spirit as a complete absence of pride, a complete absence of self-assurance and self-reliance. It means a consciousness that we are nothing in the presence of God. Utter nothingness as we come before God. That's where it has to begin. This knowledge, this understanding that we are nothing before God. This is the first, I think, because it's the key to all the others that follow. If you don't have this characteristic, if you're not poor in spirit, you're not going to have the others. This is where it begins, in recognizing your position before a holy and transcendent God, and recognizing that you have nothing and that you bring nothing to God. And so it begins there. And there's no entry into the kingdom of heaven apart from this particular trait. This is the most, well, I won't say it's the most important. It's the first. There is no one in the kingdom of heaven who is not poor in spirit. If you want to be in the kingdom, you will be poor in spirit. It is the fundamental characteristic of the Christian and of the citizen of the kingdom of heaven, and all the other ones are, in a sense, the result of this one, of being poor in spirit. And it's not just a one-time event. It's a lifelong event where we come to see God more clearly. And when you come to see Him more clearly, well, then you realize your own lack of goodness in His presence. It's a lifelong of seeing God more clearly through the eyes of faith and seeing our spiritual poverty without Him. Without God, we're nothing. So, the promise, once again, is you will have the kingdom of heaven. We define this as kingdom of heaven as God's rule in the hearts of those who willingly submit to Him through the kingdom. You can be a part of this kingdom where He is reigning in heaven. Yes, Annette?
I think we have to be careful in having that poor in spirit attitude and realizing our need for God and having an attitude like Judas had and just be done with the whole thing. So I think we have to use it as a motivation to move forward.
Great point. And we'll get that to that point in the morning, which I'm the morning part, not in the morning, but the morning part of this. How to increase the quality of being poor in spirit. I was going to take some time on this, but I'm not going to be able to. How do we increase it? I wrote on here, by looking at God, His Son, and His Word, seeing ourselves as God sees us, have a realistic view of ourselves. Contemplate standing before Him. We come to Him empty, hopeless, naked, and vile. Ephesians 2:12 is a great passage for that. Pray and study. And attend here. You know, be at the worship service and the classes. I think there is a sequence in the first three Beatitudes. So you have poor in spirit, and I think you can probably guess how that naturally flows by the examples we've already seen into mourning. So blessed are those who are poor in spirit, and blessed are those who mourn. And so this word mourning is the strongest word for mourning in all of the Greek New Testament. It's sometimes translated as wailing. But what it's not, we aren't talking about loss of money, sickness or death of loved ones, loneliness or rejection. It's not like King Ahab who wept because he couldn't have the vineyard of Naboth. It's not like Judas who wept after he sold his Lord for 30 pieces of silver. But what it is like Luke 7, 36, 38, Romans 7, 23, Luke 20. In Psalm 51, we're not going to make it too far on these, but the Luke 7 is the woman who was a sinner. What did she do when she was reclining at the table? She had the perfume.
She's at Jesus' feet crying.
She was weeping.
Yeah.
She began to wipe His feet with her tears, kept wiping them with her hair. I believe Jesus said she loved much because she was what?
Forgiven.
Yes, much.
Much. Yeah. And that again is understanding your place before God.
So it shows how she's humble, she's sorry, there's shame there,
And she doesn't want to face one who is so holy, and she's mourning over her sins. What does Paul say about this battle between the flesh and the spirit in Romans 7?
He does the things that he doesn't want to do and doesn't do the things he should do.
Yes.
Wretched man.
Wretched man that I am. Who will set me free from this body of death? Okay, so this idea of mourning, he's moved over the fact that he is a sinner. What is he going to do about it? Luke 22, here we have Peter, and we have the scene where Jesus is able to see Peter in the courtroom of the high priest. Yes, sir.
I guess one question I had is, really, what's like the difference between mourning versus like being poor in spirit? They're of course related, but like,
right.
I guess what's the distinction?
Poor in spirit, I think, is seeing how you are absolutely nothing in God's presence. Nothing good within you, nothing you can bring to say, hey, I'm holy and great. But what flows from that, I believe, is, and it's part of that, what we read, but first you actually recognize you're nothing. But part of that is understanding that you are, there is this great gap because of your sin. And so it starts with the poor in spirit, recognizing that you're nothing. And so next in line is the mourning.
So even in a non-spiritual way, poverty is a state, it's a physical state. Mourning is an emotional reaction. So there's a difference. I mean, I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
One can lead
a whole lot better.
One leads to the other, right?
Okay. Well, we will. Sorry, I ran a little bit slow on this. We meant to get through two. So we'll go through the next three on Sunday morning. We'll review mourning before we move on. I wanted to hit Psalm 51 with David. So. All right, we'll see you on Sunday morning. Thanks for your listening and participation.
Thank you. James.